So, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
I would love to just start with what my first experience with one of your creations, home movies. When we talked to Aftershock, I gotta bring it up. So I was pretty excited that I got to, at least bring it up. But the w when you told me you didn't like illustrate the characters, my mind was blown. And so ever since then, I'm like, I need to know how this came about. I need to know. I would love if you don't mind telling me the story of how you created home movies and how that process like went.
Well, I'll see if I can boil it down. Think it was well, it was I started doing st I graduated from music school in Boston at Berklee College of Music, and while I was at my final year, I started getting smart about taking classes at other colleges, and I started taking writing classes at Emerson College, and I studied with a teacher who was a comedian named Mike Bent. And Mike Bent was really, really helpful. I started taking it very seriously, the comedy writing and all that stuff. And I was kind of a mus also I was a musician, and I was nearing my final year, and I didn't know what the hell I was going to do with music. I was another guitar player, and I wasn't, a bad player or anything, but I just still didn't know what the hell I was going to do. So I think in a panic, I started kind of expressing a deep desire and other things that I was also interested in, comedy. So I start taking classes, I start writing a lot of scripts. I wrote a spec script for a Seinfeld episode. It was really helpful, and I started writing a lot of sketches. That was what I was interested
What's
in.
what's a spec script?
Spec script is a this is like how you used to get a writing job. I don't even know if it's the same way. Maybe some of it is. But what you do is you write a TV show that already exists. You come up with a story, and it kind of showcases what you can do as a writer. Like, it showcases that you can write an original story, that you can speak in the voices of the characters that already exist, and that you can
Okay.
improvise inside of existing characters. It's almost like fan fiction, really. But what you're
Okay.
trying to do is also prove that you can write funny. So you can write jokes, you can write story, and you can write character. And those are the big three, So I wrote one of those, and I think another guy in the class named Greg had a sketch troupe, and he asked if I would join a sketch troupe, and I said, sure, yeah, I'd love to get on stage and start trying to do comedy and stuff. And it was, a rocky start. I was very nervous. But anyway, look, I keep going on stage, I keep doing comedy, I keep doing sketch stuff and character stuff. That seems to be what I'm most interested in. And if because I realized if I could create an okay character, then almost everything is funny.
So I did read, and I didn't read a lot, by the way, because to me it's almost like a spoiler alert. But I do think that you are extremely impressive, and I do believe that you have the right to have someone do at least some research on you, so they know what they're talking about. So I, but like I said, I'm so fascinated that I didn't want to read too much, but I did read. And sometimes what I like to do is print out people's Wikipedia pages and ask them like if they know
Is
what's
it
on their
true?
Wikipedia and stuff, because I think it's, because it's not really monitored. So per Wikipedia, one of the things that they had said was your stand-up routines are mainly based on characters you've created. And it's not saying created from a TV show, just like a character. And is that
I'd say the things that I think, I mean, I did all kinds of different stuff on stage. Any night you'd probably just try to do something new. But I think the stuff that really worked for me the most was if I would kind of inhabit a character and then try to have a little bit of a beginning, middle, and an end in the story. And it's like, it's like writing, you're just trying to like establish one thing and turn it at some point so the audience gets some kind of, you trick the audience in some way. And that was kind of how, that's kind of, and still is, I think the best stuff I ever did was character related pieces. And then I would just, go and tell jokes every once in a while, but never would it be as strong as character stuff. So that's what I would do on stage. And then one night, the show, there was a show called Dr. Katz on Comedy Central, and it was really funny. And it featured Jonathan Katz, who I think is a brilliant comedian, just a kind of a real genius, who's also a musician and also, just a joke smith and just deadpan and kind of frighteningly intelligent. So comedians would come into the comedy club that we had inhabited, me and my friends like Eugene Merman, Patrick Borelli, a bunch of other people who would go on to be comedians later on or be writers or work in the industry in one way or another. We were all pretty focused. Me and my group of friends were all pretty focused, and we wanted to figure out a way to be creative kind of on our own terms and add something new to the conversation. We all, I think we kind of like, I think a dangerous thing that we thought was to be to do something hackneyed, to do something that we'd already seen before. So I was with a group of ideological, futurist comedian people. Again, Eugene Merman, if you know who he is, he's a really funny comedian, and I think he's also got just a really big brain and a really deep sense of creativity. So he was my roommate, and so it was nice to be around that kind of energy, and it would just help me kind of keep focused on important stuff or what I thought was important artistically versus what I thought was kind of like not that important or not that exciting comedically. So I'm doing stand up. I'm doing one of these characters, and then the people from Dr. Katz see me perform, and it was a pretty good night, and I was pretty funny, and I knew that their table was like over on the side, so I kind of played to that table a little bit. I was maybe Machiavellian in that way, and that I knew that those are important people. I knew they worked in TV. I knew I had to make them laugh if I wanted. And that was the stakes were high, but I was pretty confident in this character that I was doing. And it ended up working. I got a call from Lauren Bouchard, who was a young man at the time working at Dr. Katz, trying to make a name for himself outside of that. And he had gotten an opportunity to put a show together for UPN, which was a junior network, kind of like the CW, which is meant that they had a broadcast hour, or they would broadcast for a quarter of the day or a fraction of the day original content, and then they would just license a bunch of TV shows. So those few hours were kind of important real estate. It was a real network. They had real advertisers and sponsors and money and all that stuff. But it was also this kind of era where the whole world was figuring out that you could do animation in a very cheap way. It just wouldn't look that exciting. Wouldn't look like The Simpsons, where you send it off overseas and you get it back and it's all really fluid. It would look a little bit more like South Park, or it would look like what we would end up doing through Dr. Katz, which is the squiggle vision thing. So I meet with Lauren, and I'm pretty ambitious at the time too. I see that like I'm trying to just get my whole body into the door and trying to like I'm seeing this as an opportunity. Not only that, I really have a lot of respect for Dr. Katz and the crew that makes that show.
Yeah,
Just
you had said before you knew that they were coming, you were saying you were already a fan of Dr. Katz. Yeah, so I bet that was pretty surreal to find out that they were going to be right there.
Well, what we knew, and me and my friends knew, is that we were like smart enough to know that there's one really great comedy show being produced in Boston, and that was Dr. Katz, and it wasn't too far away from us. We were in Harvard Square in this third floor of this Chinese restaurant doing comedy shows, and there where they made this cartoon was probably like maybe 4 miles away. It was really close. So we knew that it was around. We were aware of it. We knew if Jonathan Katz came in, we all kind of like regarded him like, like a holy figure. And then other comedians would drip through this little tiny comedy club too. Like, at the time, Louis C.K., Ron Lynch, who's a really important kind of figure in my comedy life, who is he played Mr. Lynch on Home Movies. I've shared the stage with him for thousands of hours. So a lot of those same because those people, you find them in all those shows because they're really naturally funny. They don't just have great voices. They also have a very natural comedic spirit inside of them that's really has a ton of layers to it, So Ron Lynch is one of those people who just makes me laugh and is just interested in being funny all the time. Anyway, great guy. I really liked him a lot. In fact, he kind of joined me on stage that night, where I was really funny in front of all those producers from the show. And I think that kind of helped get my foot in the door too, was just me associating myself with him, because I think they already knew him. And they thought, oh, he's friends with him. And they thought maybe I'm in this comedy community, which I really wasn't. I wasn't even a year into doing stand up at that point. And also I was failing a lot too. I was not really funny all the time. I was really just kind of trying a lot of stuff out, trying to figure out, and also trying to get over stage fright and stuff too, because I really had playing guitar in front of people was always very tricky for me, because I would just get nervous. I'd care so much that I would get nervous.
And open mics are meant for comedians to test out material, figure out what works, what doesn't, and also to overcome certain fears like that, like stage fright.
I mean, it really is, like, when you look at it really and truthfully, you have to realize it's kind of a selfish endeavor, in that I'm doing this for me to get better. And I'm sorry to the audience. I'm
Yep.
gonna try my best to entertain you, but I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing here.
Yep.
And that's the only way to do it, is to jump on stage. You cannot kind of pre-shape that in your head. You have to go and experience and experiment. But ultimately, what I was trying to do was trying to be able to get to a place where I could think clearly on stage and be able to, acknowledge what was happening in the moment and pull myself out of a tough spot if I needed to, and hopefully just entertain people, and it took me a long time even figuring out those simple rules to know to follow them. Anyway, it was like up and down, and then the character stuff would work more. Next thing I know, I'm meeting with Lauren, and the next thing I know, he says, I've got this opportunity to put a TV show together, and it's a family show. And I'm thinking you, I'm thinking Paula Poundstone, I'm thinking John Benjamin, and that's all we kind of knew really. And we just kept on discussing it. And I think he was the one that brought up soccer, and I said, yeah, I played a lot of soccer as a kid. I had to play every sport. My dad is into sports, and I had to do. Even though I didn't care about it and wanted, I had no passion for it, I played every sport there was, from football to basketball to baseball to soccer. And so it would end up being some kind of a socializing kind of thing, and we'd all kind of not have a lot of passion in the game. Anyway, that ends up being kind of this thing. And so the next thing I know, I'm in a recording booth with John Benjamin, who's really somebody I also have a great deal of respect for and look up to comedically, because he played Ben on Dr. Katz, and that to me was just really, like, kind of, as a person who loves comedy, I love crazy, bombastic, insane stuff, from like Monty Python to even early SNL. But I also really like subtle, kind of deliberate, understated comedy a great deal too. So that's my natural sensibility. So when I'm doing Metalocalypse or anything like that, I'm taking my sense of humor and turning it to 11, because I'm so subtle. People, if my friends don't even know I'm doing jokes half the time, because I'm just usually pretty deadpan, but in a TV sense, I have to like turn these jokes up and everything. And so John Benjamin was doing a great job at all that stuff, and just thinking in the moment and having just a really good brain for comedy. And so we were kind of putting these pieces together, and it was all kind of making sense. And then I started talking to somebody, not knowing who they were. And it would end up being Melissa Galski. And we would just hang out like brother and sister all the time. And we would just razz each other. She grew up with a brother. I grew up with a sister. We kind of knew like how we fit into a family dynamic. And we didn't play brother and sister, but we kind of acted like a brother and sister almost every single time we talked to each other, including now when we hang out on the phone and stuff. I talk to Melissa all the time.
I love that.
And, yeah, she's awesome. She's really cool, and she's a big part of kind of the fact that she has all these kind of loud, aggressive, masculine people around her, like McGurk or Jason, who are both John Benjamin, or my character, or whatever character. She's always really, really good at holding her own, and her energy is really funny. Anyway, we become kind of friends, and I start saying, I think Melissa should be in this show. I don't know. I mean, she's just really funny naturally, and she's just kind of got, obviously, she used to be Jonathan Katz's assistant also. And
Had she acted before this in any way?
no,
Still, okay.
she hadn't, but she was like, but she'd like, she, but everyone, see, the thing is, everyone that was in this group was all interested in, it was the 90s, and everyone was interested in show business and
Oh
independent
yeah.
film. And it was a pretty creative time too, because there was cool stuff going on in comedy. This alternative comedy wave was happening. You had your Mitch Hedbergs, and you had Mr. Show, and you had all these really funny, real kind of like virtuosic talents, I think, happening in comedy. And it was a pretty, but, and also it wasn't super saturated. So guys like me and Eugene and our friends could kind of take over a comedy club and just kind of use it as our comedy workout gym, and do absurdist, stupid, idiotic things all night and waste time or irritate people. But we were learning our what to do on stage.
So was Melissa interested in doing the show with you?
Yeah, I mean, she was attracted to all that stuff, and she was interested in all that idea and all those ideas. I know that she like PA'd on films before and stuff, so she was like interested in all that stuff. And there was a lot of movie talk. And I also was a kid. At some point, I was doing this improv stuff, and I was like, we're kind of like trying to figure out how old Brendan was. And I didn't, my natural, I was, there was like a cutesy thing that was kind of happening. And I was trying to like make him older all the time because it got a little too cute for my taste. And I don't think we needed it because I thought the characters were pretty solid. So we were kind of talking about it. And I think there was like, I was doing this improv where I was doing a lot of characters at once talking to like toys of mine. And then we started going, how old is this kid? And I kept on thinking, I'd like for this kid to have his own world outside of, school and soccer and all that stuff. And I kept thinking, how can I take all the sketch comedy and kind of cram it into the show? And I thought, well, I did it all the time when I was a kid with a movie camera. So that maybe that's what we're doing. Maybe we're kind of actively making movies. So we don't seem like infants anymore. We seem like we're kind of kids there whose brains are developing around 8 or 9 years old. And so that's so the, all that development started happening. And then yeah, I think the first day that I met with John Benjamin, we recorded half of the first episode just by improv. The first scene we did together was where he was coming into the house to go on a date with my mother, who was Paula Poundstone at the time. And my job was to not let him in unless he convinced me that he was not going to be a total asshole or something like that. So he got the improv, I got the improv, and we took it really far. He didn't break any rules, I didn't break any rules, and it was a really good chunk of stuff that ended up being in the first episode. And so we kind of sat back at the end of that day and we thought, wow, that was actually pretty fruitful.
Yeah, like
And
wait, actually, you guys, we kind of nailed it.
well, yeah, I mean, I was excited because I'd never done anything like that before. And but I also thought, like, I don't want this to suck. I don't want to fool myself into thinking
Yeah.
something is good when it isn't. But to me, I think there's enough of a genesis of this. And it kept on kind of sparking more logic. And I realized the best thing, even though I was kind of like, I was 23 at the time, and I was writing and taking writing seriously. So I had a stack of scripts. So when I wasn't playing my guitar, I was probably sitting at a coffee shop trying to work on scripts or doing something just to kind of learn how to do it better and to get used to it. Plus, writing to me is somewhat therapeutic in that,
100%.
I would just like, if whenever I felt bad or something, I would sit with a notebook and start writing, and I would start feeling better because I could write about whatever's going on in my life and even have some kind of objectivity when I read it back later on. You're like, oh, this guy's upset about that, but the guy was me, so it was helpful to see all that stuff. And then yeah, so the show kept on developing from there, and that's kind of how the whole thing started.
Did you know what the characters were going to look like when you guys did your first take?
No, and in fact,
So, can I
I
ask,
saw, yeah.
was that at all difficult to, because you guys went in, you ended up, basically improvising the first half of an episode, like you said, but you didn't feel like not knowing what your characters were going to look like, you feel like that didn't affect the way you guys were like
Well,
able to.
it's even better to not know what the characters look like, I think, especially when you're creating it, because you're not.
Because that's not your part. So
Well, honestly,
you don't want to like get blinded by that, because like that's not your focus. Your focus is the voice and the comedy, and someone else's focus is the art, it's the illustration itself.
I didn't really think visually because the way that this company was working with me and the way that I understood Dr. Katz was that it was all about the audio first and foremost. It
Awesome.
was about getting your character working in audio. So when you're just listening to speakers, you have two speakers in front of you, and you're just listening back to some improv, you're just looking nowhere and you're hearing stuff, and your imagination is kind of more exciting than the visual in some way. So when you see the visuals, I realized I always thought this show wants to be, because it came from Dr. Katz, and I thought, well, this show wants to be a little bit more visual than Dr. Katz, but it was really strange. This is kind of like something that they did back in the day. They said, don't talk to the artist. We don't talk to the artist. And I thought, this is crazy. What do you mean we don't talk to the artist? Aren't we collaborating here?
Yeah.
And so that was kind of part of the rule there, and I was always perplexed by it and still am, but whatever, what do I care? I was like just brought in, I was just brought in as I think they thought I was just gonna be an actor, but I ended up, having these scripts and this readiness and willingness to kind of take on the writing part of it. And then at some point, this is, by the way, this is right after I'd graduated from music school, and I'd kind of taken my guitar at that point and gone like, I don't know what I'm gonna do with you. You just hang out. I'll get to you later, but I think I got to pursue all this comedy stuff. Then at some point, the show seems to be making sense, and we're all kind of cautiously optimistic about it. We're like, I think this is really adding up. I'm like, yeah, it's kind of good. And I remember, like, I think Benjamin at some point was like, yeah, it's got legs, doesn't it? And I was like, oh wow, he thinks it's cool. Okay, I think it's pretty cool too. And really, it was like it was for it, it almost seemed like where the show kind of ended up. It was very much a show that the people in that room could say, yeah, we think it's cool. And this show is kind of something that we would maybe be interested in. And that was an important thing to us to have it be a show that we would, even though it's about kids and a single mother and all that stuff, and it's not really terribly edgy or anything, it was something that we were all kind of very interested in protecting and adding to. And so we all kind of gave it our own personal thumbs up. And then, the show was totally rocky from that point on. We would do five episodes. We had a very, very small budget. And then the show really performed poorly when it came out. It premiered, and I remember in Boston, we had a big party, and the whole like studio that made it, the Tom Snyder Productions at the time, that turned them. Changed their name to Soup to Nuts. They had a big party, and our premiere got preempted by like a Bruins game or something like that. Like some hockey game came on, and we were like, oh boy, this is like a very bad start. And so and it went kind of downward from there. And then after five episode airing, I think they aired five episodes and re-aired two episodes, and they said, we cannot, this is turning people off. They don't know what this is. They don't think it's so good. And the worst thing was happening, which was that people tuned in and we had a big, big following, and then it would just dwindle down to nothing because people are like, I don't know what this, they're just talking to each other and it's boring. And so, but we knew it was cool. We knew it was a little bit ahead of its time. And then we got canceled. So we got canceled, and we're like, well, easy come, easy go. See you later. I thought it was pretty cool. Me too. I thought it was pretty cool too. Oh, well, what are you going to do? And then we got a call about like, maybe just a few months later from what would end up being Adult Swim, saying, hey, can you go back into production? We like your show. We think it's cool. We're starting this new adult block of animation. And it hadn't aired yet. It was just this concept at the time.
So
And we
like
saw your.
Adult Swim wasn't a thing
Yeah, this is,
yet.
we premiered in 1999, 25 years ago, on UPN. And like just like almost like that, the match went out. It was like over. And then that was the same time they were gearing up to get this thing started because it didn't exist yet, the Adult Swim.
Adult Swim didn't exist yet.
Yeah, exactly. So
Okay.
later on that same year, we would be back in production. That's almost like we'd never lost our jobs. And not only that, we had a bigger order. We had to complete like the first, I guess, a 13 episode order because we had five already and we had to do the other eight. And so it made us think, okay, here's a second chance to do this thing. What do we want to do that we didn't do in the first five? And then we heard that Paula Poundstone wasn't interested in coming back. And it all added up to us, her reasons. And she just thought it wasn't her thing. And we're like, oh, geez, what are we going to do? And then Adult Swim was like, well, just recast her. And so I was really happy to find, or to offer the idea that Jeanine DiTullio, who was a writer for Conan O'Brien, she was a monologue writer, super sharp as hell, super deadpan, super funny, and a great stand-up, and just incredibly smart. And we thought, like, I think she's going to be the new Paula. And so we brought her in, and we're like, yeah, she's funny, she's outstanding, and I think this is a perfect fit. And so she would end up doing the lion's share of the entire series. We did 52 episodes, and she did all of those but five. So that would be the team, and we just keep on moving forward. Oh, another important team member was, especially when we came back from Adult Swim, was bringing on Bill Broaddus as a writer. And Bill Broaddus, I looked up to a great deal. A really, really sharp comedian. A little bit older than me, like, about 10, 15 years older than me. But I really wanted a really great writer to work with, so that someone who I really, really respected, because I wanted to learn how to be a better writer. And so Bill was so funny. And every time he brought a script in, I was like, it was a really healthy competition. He wanted to have the funniest script. I wanted to have the funniest script. And it's really like, and the audience ends up winning in those kinds of cases. And then also at the same time, we would write these scripts, write these jokes, and then yield to a human moment through improv. If that were to outweigh what we wrote, then we'd say, forget it. Use that. We wrote jokes, but screw it. I got more jokes in my head. And we would yield to whatever happened in the moment. Sometimes a sigh was funnier than a line that was articulated well. So we would continue. And every time we had a season, we would think, okay, that's it. We had a good shot and we blew it. And then we get put brought back, even though our ratings were never good. So every time we got a new season, it was kind of a gift from the Adult Swim.
Because they liked it.
I
And
think, yeah, they internally liked it.
also they were new as well, right? Like, I mean, one,
They
they
were new as
liked it.
well, but
Or are you saying other shows were doing better? Like Adult
oh
Swim
yeah,
didn't
without it. I
need you?
mean, the truth was that they were licensing shows like, I think at that point they'd kind of helped to bring back the Family Guy, because that had such a big following that, and then it got canceled as well. And they brought it back on Adult Swim, and the following, and everyone's watching it over there now. Then Fox was like, oh, wait a minute, hold on. Maybe we were too hasty. Maybe we should bring that back. So everyone's canceling shows and bringing them back to life everywhere. The really kind of exciting thing about the Adult Swim is that it was kind of a little bit more punk rock than other TV, in that they didn't need to be there in the first place, but they had figured out a way to get viewers into late night TV on this crazy, mostly kids network. It would only turn into an adult network at night.
I wasn't allowed to watch.
Exactly. And that's also probably what made you watch it in the first place, was that you weren't allowed, which is also kind of, seductive, is that it's not for you, you can't do it, you're too young. So all that stuff is happening. Plus they had, it was their way or the highway. So creatively, it meant that they wanted to do what they wanted to do. They had an ideology. This is something I think is not in show business right now. Most things are corporately run, and it's usually run by a team of corporate people who were,
They look at numbers.
well, there's not one person saying, I want a network that feels like this when I was a kid, and something like that. And that's what Adult Swim was. And to their credit, they really built a lot of shows, because they had a really kind of like a real fuck you kind of creative spirit. And that's really important. And I am really lucky that I was in the right place in the right time to kind of be in that world, where I got to, just like that empty comedy club, got to start playing and figuring out what it is that I was interested in. And home movies was just a new challenge that I'd never sorted out. And we didn't know how to make the show. We had to figure it out on our own. And we did 4 seasons. And when the fourth season came, they said, listen, we're giving you a fourth season. It's kind of just considered a gift. We cannot do any more of the show. It doesn't do well enough. So here's the fourth, but you know what your last episode is. And so I thought, okay, that's great. I can write the last episode in the way that concludes the show, that I think is kind of a final statement, of the series. So that's what, so we were lucky enough to know our final episode, to write it. in a way that we felt was.
I feel like Adult Swim just absolutely loves you guys because there are so many shows out there that don't know when it's over, and the audience doesn't get closure, and the people in it don't get closure. And so, I love that they kept you on because they loved the show. And then I love that they were like, hey, dude, we're gonna be done after this. And were you okay with that?
We were ready. We thought at the time too. I didn't think my goal was never to be on a TV show that lasted forever. That was not something that I was interested in because I think it's almost a nightmare of your own making where you have to keep making the same show until you die. You know, you just have to keep rowing the boat and there's never someone you can hand the oar off to. I think the shows that I grew up on had a beginning and an end, and they ended everything, you know. But we're now in an era that thinks very differently. They want to keep IP alive forever. So there's never a the end at the end of a story, you know? And I do think it's important to say the end. And I was lucky enough to have the opportunity because most shows also, they get canceled and you don't get
That's
the
what I'm
conclusion,
saying. Yeah.
you
That's why I liked that
know?
Adult Swim gave you a heads up rather
Yeah,
than,
they're like, we're firing you, but now you know. And
yeah.
we're like, okay, good.
It's like a 2 week notice at a job. It's like, hey, you're jobless after this. Here's your,
There's that,
season.
but I really think maybe part of the reason people are still talking to me about it, because it comes up all the time, it really does, that was that we did get to end it. If we just left it open-ended and it just kind of like never finished, I think people would think a little bit differently. But because we've got to put the kind of the closure in the show, I think it feels like a complete piece. And I am very happy that we got to do that. And I am really happy with how the show ended. And my memories of the show are really good. I was still like a young, frustrated guy who was trying to like sort out how to do all this stuff. I had a really good team of people that were collaborating with me on everything. It was my job to kind of like sit there and go, okay, here's what the first episode is, here's what the final episode is. Then Bill and I would disappear. We'd have a lot of meetings together, and then we'd kind of present this stuff to the rest of the team. We'd kind of see how what everybody else felt, and then make sure we're all making the same show, and then throw the script away and do improv on top of everything anyway, which is also kind of like a final rewrite, you know? So all I remember is that really, really great creative spirit, really, really good company. We all really respected each other and wanted to make the other person laugh. At least I did, you know? So I mean, I don't think it's almost like getting kind of like the ultimate job. And so right when you get into the industry, we had c creative control. We got to make the show we wanted to make, and there's no real downside other than and I think it needed to be four seasons. You know, there have been talks over the years. People ask me, oh, would you ever consider bringing it back? And I think that show has definitely done what it needed to do, and it was at that important era. Making it now would be completely different.
I think that I okay, so South Park, they are a show where the kids, I think that they made it to fourth grade and they never, aged. But their show, that dynamic is set completely different, completely,
Oh
like
yeah, it's totally different.
unrealistic, and a lot of current events, things like that. And
Yeah.
the way that Home Movies was made, they were kids, and the way that that show is, I feel like eventually they would have to grow up, they would have to age because of, the way that the characters are developed and stuff. It did have to end. It couldn't go. I agree with you in the sense that it couldn't go more than four seasons. It's like
Well,
you want it
yeah.
to, but then eventually it's like, it's like Boy Meets World, right? Like they start off what in like the sixth grade, and we follow them all the way to college. It's like it would have to kind of play like that, in my opinion, just because of the way that the story really lined up, and the fact that like I know it was animation, but they were, it was realistic, if that makes sense. I don't know if there's a
Well, it's
terminology for
strange.
that.
It's trying to be grounded within its own kind of terms, and that's kind of that was the idea, is that it's I guess the term that we would use is to make it somewhat grounded in that it's not absurdist. It's not anything can happen. South Park is, first of all, I think South Park is great, and I think it's still really funny, and I think they have a really good reason for being on the air
100%.
because they're a voice of satire and a consistent voice. So, but yeah, I mean, our show was this little kind of indie idea that was really scrappy, and yeah, it was like I said, I mean, when people bring it up to me, I always think, it was really fun to make. It was always fun. It was easier than anything. Metalocalypse, I would start adding music into it, and even though I did a lot of music for home movies, it was always really simple and ratty and out of tune and kind of punk rock. And then Metalocalypse, I was like, okay, I'm gonna get everything's gonna get a little bit more complicated here because I'm really gonna take the music part very, very seriously, and so shows are gonna be articulated differently and made differently, and there's a lot more kind of building involved and blueprints involved and a lot more assembly required, where it's where and also visual ideas and all the stuff and also by the time Metalocalypse came, I had done home movies, so I thought, that is great, I did that. I want to honor it by not trying to copy it. I
Oh,
would much
yeah.
rather create a brand new world that doesn't, like, I'd rather, my favorite actors are character actors when you can't recognize them from one movie to the next.
Exactly.
I remember seeing Sacha Baron Cohen early, early on the Ali G days, not realizing that he was also Borat because he had like changed his eyes enough and it changes everything about him. And I thought, that's exciting to me. He's really doing what I think acting is and I think as a showrunner or a show creator, you can also be an actor too. And that one is this kind of sweet pastel mother and son story about creativity, and the other one's about this brutal world of masculinity and heavy metal, and
So,
but creative, also a creative family.
do you find it, or do you get kind of annoyed that people want to talk to you about home movies, or do you not mind?
No, I don't mind. I mean.
Oh, it's just like because you had made a comment about like how people like always bring it up to you, you know, and so I was like, oh, so that is something you're very known for.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the thing is also probably when I talked to you at the festival, I was talking to lots of people. I was doing like meet and greets and stuff with Metalocalypse fans, but as it turns out, there's a lot of crossover between those two shows, even though tonally they really are different. So
100%.
it's so I mean, and also, I mean, I don't go out and talk to people that often, so of course people are going to probably bring up the things that I'm known for. So I have no problem with it. I only have really good feelings about home movies. I really feel proud of the show. I can't believe that I had that much artistic, was allowed to have that much kind of creative autonomy inside of that show. And I mean, we would also kind of like deliberate and kind of argue over the best idea, all that stuff, but I think that's part of creativity, and I really like that a lot too, is like two lawyers arguing to prove a theorem, and no matter what happens, that argument propels a stronger logic by just talking to somebody else. So all those things I think are really, really important. Without it, I think shows can be pretty boring. So yeah, I never mind talking about it. Anytime someone brings it up, it's always, I always think it is positive.
I think like when I met you, you know, I really wanted to just, you know, talk about Death Clock. We were at Aftershock, and I was extremely taken back the second I heard your voice, because I was like, holy
Because
fucking
that's
shit,
my voice, and
holy
it's a
fucking
lower
shit,
version of.
that's Brendan Small.
Right, yeah.
Like, that's Brendan Small, Brendan Small. That's the voice in the show. That's like, you know, it's your voice. And it
You were
just,
coming to a realization that I was using my voice, and that's the same voice as the
and it
character.
was like, just like I said, I'm such a huge fan. And so, like, I instantly, I mean, yeah, you know, if you don't remember me, you probably will after I remind you how nervous I was. I was like almost in fetal position the entire time that we spoke outside in the chairs with the boys and stuff. It was too surreal
You
for
were going
me.
through a series of emotions.
Oh my, it was just too much. You know what I mean? I was like, what do you mean? That's the The voice that's on the and I thought Home Movies was, I mean, it was just so brilliantly done. But the biggest thing, that the main reason why I wanted to talk to you like about that show is because, you know, that is what you started with, and to learn that you had so much creative control, to learn that you weren't part of the illustration process, and it just made me really want to dive in deeper on, you know, like, wow, how did we get there? I like that you decided to go with the making of the home movies to try and jam all of your ideas into one show, because your brain's overflowing and you know, you're like, I have all these things. I want to know if I can incorporate, you know, so much. And I liked that you wanted Brendan to be older, but you know, for the basis, you need him to be a child. You based him off of some of your experiences. Did you only grow up with a mom as well? So,
No, there's a lot of stuff that was,
and that's why
my,
I said some.
yeah.
That's why I just wanted to double check that, because
Yeah,
I know that a lot. It's not 100% based off of you. You know, you got the idea for the soccer, you know, in the home movies and stuff off of some things. But I like that you wanted him to be older, but you needed him to be younger. And by putting him, in my opinion, with a single parent, is how you were able to get him to be younger but older. Because when you know, he's the man of the house, and so he's got to, you know, kind of grow up a little bit. But he's at the same time, he's 8 years old. So you were really able to, you know what I mean, portray that.
well, you know what I realize as I keep doing any of these things creatively is that at some point it's really nice if someone gives you a couple of pieces that you're stuck with, and you have to ask yourself, how do I make this all work? And what, is there a kind of an inherent logic here that I can listen to? It makes sense. I didn't want to do a really cute show where kids were like babies and there's like Muppet babies or anything like that, because that's what I thought we were kind of in danger of doing. And I always thought when I was a kid, I took myself like kids aren't like, floppy and silly all the time. They're going through the same kind of crises that we're going through. They just don't know how to deal with it. And they just don't have the words to describe it. And that's what I felt like when I was a kid. My life was dramatic when I was a kid. I moved when I was really young. I lost everything. I lost all my friends and had to go to another place. So I had to like make new friends, and I would make friends with all the weird kids because they'd all moved also. So all the army brats and all those kids and all the people with the 1,000-yard stare, those are the kids I would hang out with. And we weren't all trying to be cute. We were like little adults, trying to hold on to whatever it was that we could when our lives were spinning out of control. So that's what I thought too. And then when I think about creativity and what we, what I do for a living, what friends of mine do for a living, I think we're given a certain amount of things, and we just have to make it work with our own kind of our own taste, our skill set, and whatever kind of assets that we have, like time or artists or whatever it is. You take this thing and you go, okay, let's not embarrass ourselves. What do you say? And then everyone kind of comes to a conclusion. And that's usually how you make a show. Really, that's the actual secret to making a show. What would I really like to see? What do I think? Who is this show for? Well, this show's kind of for me when I was a little kid growing up and being creative. And why am I being creative? Because my life is spinning out of control and I've got nothing to hold on to other than the idea that I can probably control everything inside of this viewfinder of this camera. I can tell people what to wear. I can tell people what to say. And it gives me the illusion of control while everything else is crashing and burning around me. And I thought that's what this character is. That's who Brendan is. And that's who his friends are too. And they're all, and also, all my friendships are creative. Everybody that I hang out with, we're always talking about creative things, from my entire life, from guitar, from whatever it is. I'm hanging out with people and discussing how to be better at whatever it is that I want to do, at guitar, music, comedy, acting, whatever it is.
What I think is also really great is that you have to think about it, but you don't. If so, when you watch the show, you do get the take that, you know, these are the kids, their life's spinning out of control, you know, things like that. But at the same time, it's not, which if anyone has experienced their life spinning out of control, it is never obvious, right? Like we we don't make it obvious. We do make jokes of it, or we talk about it very quick in passing. And Melissa's mom is passed, and Jason's parents are never home. They're I believe that they're just loaded and always leaving him. And then Brendan is with his mom, and his mom is kind of a train wreck. She's super great, but she's kind of having a hard time, you know, working, money, you know, things like that. But the thing is that that's not what you notice in the episodes. You know what I mean? And that's
It, yeah.
that's what real life is too, when we are going through crap. And but it's mentioned, all these things are mentioned, but they are mentioned super quick in passing. Jason always kind of makes a joke of it, you know, and you know, people will tell you that comedians sometimes were like the most depressed people, and you know, make light of things and stuff. And you can just see like these kids, they're doing that. They're all they're eight, all the things that I mentioned, those are pretty like drastic things, you know what I mean? Losing a parent, having a single mom, worrying about money, and then Jason, I like, who takes care of that kid, you know what I mean? And at the same time, they have all figured out a way to cope. And because they're so young, they don't actually notice that they are coping, you know what I mean? They don't know, like, 'cause you don't learn that stuff until you're later. So I think it's just a really cool concept. It's a deep show, and I always just got that feeling when I was watching it that, like, you know, there was a lot more to it. And that is why that was one of the biggest things that, like, I wanted to talk to you about, was because I think that people deserve to know, one, if you've never seen the show, to watch it, and two, just the story behind the show, you know, like the fact that you got picked up for five episodes, you got to start with Adult Swim, and like, you know, it's just so cool. And I love all the humor in it. And I think that, you know, with Metalocalypse, so I don't like metal, and I love Metalocalypse, and I love the music in it. And I loved watching you perform at Aftershock. It was so intense. Like I said, I don't like metal, but there's, and so I know that I can't really speak on it because, but I can just tell you this much. I have a lot of friends who like metal. They play it around me, and I don't enjoy it. Metalocalypse plays, and I like have emotion. I get like goosebumps. I'm like, God, that's so fucking hard. Like, damn, that's so awesome. I got into the show because the person I was dating at the time, he, you know, loved the show. And I know that for his birthday one year, I made him a birthday cake. I put candles on it and surprised him with it by blaring, you know, Death Clock's birthday song, and brought it out with candles instead of singing him happy birthday, you know. So I just know that, like, I don't know what it is about it, but it makes, like I say, I just get emotion like whenever I hear it. Like, and I can hear it. I don't have to be watching the show, you know what I mean? Like, if it, you know, I can play it on my Spotify, like, and enjoy it. So I don't know what it is about Death Clock versus like any other like metal type band.
Well,
I do feel, and I you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like we talked about like your humor, and you had said that with your humor, you have to crank it up to an 11. And I feel like when you're making music for Death Clock, every single song, you are trying to turn it up to 11. Every single song is fucking brutal. It would, you know, every single song would hit number one. You know, there is a reason why they are, you know, so successful and stuff. And it is, and people crave every time a song is dropped. And so I feel like you have to do that every time you write a song to.
see, I think what you're saying is in the world that we've created, that Death Clock is the number one band in that world. So yeah, so the music has to So the challenge is, how do you make a song that seems like it would actually be the number one song in the world like that? So yeah, that's the trick. And I don't know if there's a question there beyond that, but that's the idea, is like, how do you try to write something that sounds good? You know, seriously, like, what is the I sit there, and the great thing about writing music is that I mean, when I write comedy or I write a script, I think it's funny, but my sense of humor is personal often. It doesn't always go to, it doesn't land everywhere, you know? And also, even in trying to be funny, you could miss a step that makes the joke land. It happens on stage all the time with comedians. They're working out new stuff. But with music, I can write a demo and my guitar can be out of tune. I can be playing it badly, but I'll still feel the energy of the song. And what is music ultimately but some kind of delivery system of emotion, hopefully. And there's a lot of, they won't say it because there's like emo, then all music beyond emo is not emotional. Metal is so emotional. It's so like, it is, there's so much masculinity and so much rage inside of metal that kind of gets something out that's really important that never really is safe to get out, you know? And when I say masculinity, I think everyone has this masculine rage inside of them somewhere. And the idea is, how do you do this and make it sound good at the same time? And where's that energy, and where's the what's the emotional pull, and who am I talking to, and all that stuff. And then also, what does it just sound like on my ears? You know, what does it sound like on my ears? Can I use chords? Because I have no melody in the voice, because he's basically rapping in a guttural death metal voice. Where can I put the melody in, and where can I sneak it into the guitar so you really feel a pull from one section change to the next, and that little transference makes you go, oh, that's nice, or something like that. That's what I'm looking for, is some emotional connection all the time. And every once in a while I go, oh, even though I'm making it, I'm the audience of it, I'm making it, but I can be the audience of it at the same time. So when I hear two chords contradict or clash, I can go, yes, that's something I'm looking for. No, that's not. Also, when I'm like writing a piece of music, I'm lucky enough if I know what it is I'm going for. If I'm going for some kind of feeling of melancholy triumphant feeling, you know, like, what is that? Oh, you're sad, but you've conquered something, but it's melancholy, whatever it is. Like, can I tap into what that feels like? Can I tap into grandiosity? Can I tap into this, that, the other thing? Can I tap into something that makes us feel like we're all in this together? All that stuff is part of what heavy metal can deliver that a lot of genres of music cannot. And that's why metal's so important to me. First of all, I love guitar. I love guitar more than anything. And it's the prominent instrument. And when I was 13 to 15, I was really sculpting out my personality through the musical choices I made. Meaning that when you're a teenager, when you're starting to hit that really kind of, when you're starting like to change and your brain is going everywhere and you don't know who you are anymore, and you don't have any money and you don't have any autonomy, and your parents are telling you what to do, what is the one thing you can do? You can listen to the music that you choose, and no one can stop you from doing that, really. And I was talking to those guys with Metalocalypse, and I was having a conversation with those kids who were also discovering creativity through guitar, through heavy metal, through expression, and all that stuff. And that's so years ago when that show came out, I was talking to teenagers, and now those teenagers are in their 30s. And I'm going and talking to them now in person, and they're going like, wait a minute, why is this still in my brain? And I'm saying, because I was talking directly to you, but really I was talking to myself. I was trying to give me, young me, a show that he would like, that would maybe calm his crazy brain into some kind of nice, entertained, and kind of relaxed state. Because that's what heavy metal really does actually do, is it creates a chaos, but it also creates like a very calm eye of the storm underneath it.
Yeah, it's a place to put the chaos, right? Is, you know, what you're
Yeah,
saying?
yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
So, I am, you know, disappointed that we don't have 12 hours. I knew
Oh yeah, it
that
is good. Yeah, I do have to get going, but yeah.
I did know that there was more in depth with everything, you know? And so that is why I wanted to start with home movies, was because I knew that there was a lot there, but it does suck because there is so much that.
Well, let me say this. We are going on tour starting April 7th. It's the Mutilation on a Spring Night tour with Deathcock, with Dragon Force, and with Necrogoblicon. And we're really excited. I can't believe that I am living the life of a working musician, and it's really exciting. It's really fun. I really like this band. I really like this crew. I like the bands we're touring with. And we're going to be in San Francisco with Baby Metal. We're kind of getting back together with them for two shows because we never got to do the San Francisco market because we did the Aftershock thing. So we're coming back. So I hope to see. I think those shows are close to selling out. So I'd say check out the dates. You can go to my Instagram, Brendan at Brendan Small, BrendanSmoan, and same with my Twitter. And you should be able to see tickets and all that stuff there. But check it out. We're very excited to be taking this really crazy project on the road that is celebrating, heavy metal and creativity. And also, all the people that like home movies are all going to be there. So you'll see a lot of your friends or new friends there. They're all.
I love everything that you've created. Everything. Metalocalypse, Death Clock, I loved watching you guys at Aftershock. And if people haven't seen you perform, they 100% need to. It's completely worth it. It's an experience like no other. It's such a cool experience. I had no idea what to expect. Very, very cool. You guys bring a lot of
Well,
energy.
we played a picture. So we have a gigantic movie screen that's an LED screen, and we've got this very articulated, worked out show. My idea with Metalocalypse and the fun about trying to create a show like this that has all this different kind of media is to make the show stand on its own, to make the comedy stand on its own, to make the characters stand on their own, to make the music stand on its own if there is no TV show, and then to make the live show. If you don't know the TV show and if you don't know the music, you're going to be in for an experience that you won't forget. It's to me, the way I describe it is it's like going to Universal Studios and going to like an amusement park ride, to like the T2 all immersive thing where there's a good guy, there's a bad guy, there's the audience boos, the audience cheers, and we've got a whole fun show that makes you just that really is energetic and really fun, you know. And to us, it's really like I've got the best seat in the house because I get to watch everybody react to all of it. And there's a lot of it's just really fun. Like that's the experience. People get really excited, and it's all these scary heavy metal people with big smiles on their faces, and it's ridiculous to watch, and I love it.